Rhys is going to lead off.
Thank you, Leslie. So we're on agenda reference 3 and 134. So it's good to be back. I think it's about 6 months since we last discussed revenue. A lot's happened since then. Obviously, finally, we've got our fancy colleagues there. I should just, although they're not on screen, welcome two new FASB members to the team. We've got Phil and Mike. As of Friday, also, Alison joined the IFB team.
Come say hi.
So we have grown, which is good. We've got four papers this afternoon. Phil? the first is the comment letter summary. Now, Glenn and Libby will introduce this paper, but I'd just like to take this opportunity to acknowledge, I think, the tremendous efforts of Libby, Stephanie and Liz at the FASB for processing and analysing nearly 1,000 comment letters. I think they've done a terrific job. And also, I just should just say thanks to Libby and wish her well, because this is her last meeting with us, as she will be leaving at the end of the month and joining practice. Following that, we have an appendix to that memo. Now, Liz prepared this memo to summarise the feedback to question 18 in the FASB's ED on whether the proposals should differ for non-public entities. And we have agenda paper 3B, which April prepared to summarise our outreach activities over the last few months. We know you've received sort of separate reports on these, but we just thought it would be good to pull it all together. The plan this afternoon, though, is that we're not going to specifically talk either to that appendix or the outreach memo, but obviously if you've got questions or comments on either of those, then we can deal with that when we open up the comment letter summary for you to comment on. And then the final paper is the paper 3C on the plans for redeliberation, and Kenny will lead the discussion on that. Now, we've got about an hour and a half for the discussion this afternoon. If we're still sort of talking about the comment letter summary after about an hour, we'll probably draw it to a close to leave time for the project plan. But with that, I'm going to now hand over to Libby, who will kick us off on the overview of the comment letters received.
Thanks, Henry. Good afternoon. IFB Agenda Reference 3A and FASB Agenda Reference 134A summarize the feedback received in response to the exposure draft revenue from contracts with customers. The summary is based on the staff's preliminary analysis of respondents' comment letters, as well as on feedback received from outreach activities. The exposure draft was issued on June 24, 2010, and the comment period ended on October 22, 2010. To date, the boards have received nearly 1,000 comment letters in response. Three main factors help explain this high response rate. First, revenue recognition has universal relevance to general purpose financial reporting, so constituents representing a large number of industries responded to the ED. Those industries include construction, manufacturing, telecommunications, technology, financial services, biotech and pharmaceutical, transportation, and even media and entertainment, including the NFL. Second, since the revenue recognition project is a joint project, comment letters have come from a geographically diverse range of respondents. Finally, a substantial number of letters have been received in response to questions asked by the FASB on whether the board's proposals should apply to private companies in the United States. Most of those responses were received from U.S. companies in the construction industry and from accounting firms and surety providers that would like existing construction accounting guidance to be retained. The appendix of this paper details the private company concerns that were expressed by respondents. The private company's question and its relevance to the U.S. construction industry had an influence on the respondent statistics that are included in the paper. Many of the comment letters from preparers, individuals, and accounting firms were in response to the proposed model's application to the construction industry. Similarly, of the 10% of responses from users, most were from providers of surety bonds for the construction industry who were asking the boards to retain the current guidance on accounting for construction contracts. Overall, respondents expressed general support for the board's efforts to develop a converged revenue recognition model for U.S. GAAP and IFRS. They appreciate the rationale for developing a single standard and largely support the core principle that an entity should recognize revenue in the amount of consideration it expects to receive from a customer when it transfers goods or services to that customer. However, respondents indicated that they have substantial concerns regarding some fundamental aspects of the model, specifically the notion of control and identifying separate performance obligations. Most respondents requested that the boards further clarify the concept of control and the application of control indicators to service contracts, as well as the principle of distinct goods or services for identifying separate performance obligations. Many respondents are concerned that, as drafted, the principle would lead to inappropriate disaggregation of the contract. Respondents worry that while some of the proposals may seem conceptually sound, it may be impractical to apply them. Some believe that even if the proposals are successfully implemented, they may not actually result in more useful financial statements. The proposals may increase consistency in financial reporting across industries, but may also reduce comparability of financial statements within industries that currently have industry-specific guidance that is well understood by users. Because of these significant concerns, many respondents have questioned whether the exposure draft provides a compelling case for changing revenue recognition standards, especially given the significant costs they expect to incur to comply with the proposed model. Respondents have applauded the boards and staff for their significant outreach efforts during the time leading up to and following the issuance of the exposure draft. However, based on the significant concerns they have with the proposals, many have asked the boards to take their time on redeliberations. They have also requested that prior to issuance of a final standard, the boards perform testing and/or re-expose the proposal for further public comment. Now Glenn will discuss some of the specific issues that constituents have raised with the proposed model.
Excellent. Thank you, Libby. I'd like to just give you a couple of highlights, talk a little bit more about the separating the contract and also control, and then very briefly just outline just a couple of the responses we received in other aspects of the model. So on separating a contract, the proposal in the exposure draft was a sort of a two-step approach to separation. The first step would be to segment a contract into separate contracts based on the principle of price independence. The second step would be to identify separate performance obligations on the basis of the principle of distinct goods or services. Now, many respondents felt that that sort of two-step approach wasn't necessary, and a single-step approach might be sufficient. And one of the reasons for that was that they noted that the main reason for segmenting a contract is to ring-fence the transaction price for the purposes of allocating any discount and allocating any changes, subsequent changes, in the transaction price. And that it might be appropriate to deal with that by a more flexible approach to allocating transaction price rather than on the basis of standalone selling prices. Now, we would still need, under that approach, we still need to identify separate performance obligations on the basis of distinct goods or services. Most people felt that was the correct principle, but felt we needed to do more to explain distinct goods and services and what they mean. And the reason for that is they felt that that could be interpreted in such a way that it could still lead to very granular recognition of performance obligations, which was one of the major concerns that respondents had to the earlier discussion paper. So the main proposals there, respondents generally agreed that if a good or service is sold separately by the entity, that that is an indication that it is a distinct good or service. However, in other cases, for instance, if a good or service is sold separately by another entity, or if it's not sold separately but has distinct function and distinct profit margin, that there might be circumstances there where we're potentially identifying goods and services that really shouldn't be considered to be distinct and therefore shouldn't be recognised as separate performance obligations. So we'll have a bit more work to do there. In terms of control, Libby mentioned that many respondents noted that we might need to further improve the definition of control, partly because it doesn't resonate well for services or for partially completed assets that transfer continuously to the customer. Also, it was felt that many of the indicators for control also don't readily apply to services. Within the agenda paper, we include various comments which were received on the specific indicators we proposed. Furthermore, respondents also requested, some further guidance on how those indicators should be used if some of those indicators point you in different directions as to whether or not control has or has not passed to the customer. Furthermore, a few respondents also suggested alternatives to the control model, including recognising revenue when risks and rewards transfer to the customer, or when based on the performance of activities under the contract. Now, very briefly, other aspects of the model, just to comment on, in terms of the transaction price and variable consideration, most disagree with using sort of probability-weighted estimates of transaction price, unless there was a portfolio of homogenous items. In all other cases, they would prefer to use management's best estimates of the transaction price. With credit risk, most respondents disagreed with reflecting customers' credit risk in their estimate of transaction price, except maybe if the entity adjusted the contract price for a specific customer to reflect that customer's specific credit risk. In other cases, they prefer to maintain sort of existing accounting, sort of dealing with credit risk in the financial assets, accounting for financial assets. Time value of money, most agreed with the principle that transaction price should be adjusted for time value of money. Oh, sorry, they agreed with that in concept. In practice, they felt it might not sort of meet cost-benefit needs, and so there might need to be some constraints over when you adjust transaction price for time value of money. Onerous performance obligations. Most respondents disagreed with recognising a liability if a performance obligation is onerous, especially when the overall contract might remain profitable. They also suggested in some cases that even testing for onerousness at the contract level might not always be appropriate, and it might sometimes be appropriate to test up at a higher level, such as a portfolio of contracts. In terms of contract costs, there was a concern that the boards, or it appears in the eyes of constituents, that the boards are adopting different treatments for contract acquisition costs in different projects. And some have also requested some more guidance on fulfilment costs, especially given the existing guidance, which is currently included in IAS 11 and in topic 605.35, which is the old SOP 81.1. In terms of disclosures, there was general support for the disclosure objective, but most respondents didn't agree with the package of disclosures that were proposed to meet that objective. They were concerned that some of the disclosures were too prescriptive and might require excessive volumes of information to be prepared, which might be inconsistent with the disclosure objective, and also that some of the disclosures proposed might be more in the nature of management commentary rather than information to be reported in general purpose financial statements. Further concerns about whether those disclosures might lead to boilerplate disclosure and or the cost to prepare and audit that information. On transition, there was mixed support as to whether the proposals should apply retrospectively. Most felt that retrospective application would provide useful trend information, but it might be not satisfy cost-benefit considerations, especially for entities with either complex multiple-element arrangements or if they have complex long-term contracts. And so some alternatives were suggested, such as a simplified approach to retrospective application, or allowing the impracticability exception to apply to a wider range of circumstances, or to permit an entity to choose whether to apply retrospectively or prospectively. Application guidance, there are mixed views as to whether the boards were proposing too little, too much, or if it was just about right. But those, I'd say probably an overall view was most felt that was the guidance was closer to be about the right volume of guidance, but perhaps it was too simple and some more specific guidance might be required, in particular to address some additional topic areas. On warranties, we proposed a cut between quality assurance warranties, which is really whether or not the entity has satisfied its performance obligation to provide the customer with the product the customer was seeking, and insurance warranties, which would be a separate performance obligation to protect against subsequent faults. Almost all respondents felt that it might be difficult to distinguish between those two warranties and suggested a simpler approach of maybe accounting for standard warranties on a cost accrual basis and separately priced warranties as a separate performance obligation. In terms of licences, we try to distinguish between licenses depending on whether the license was exclusive or non-exclusive. That was considered to introduce a bright line, and many respondents didn't think that exclusivity was necessarily the appropriate basis for determining the accounting. Anyway, that's a very quick and rushed overview of the responses we've received. I might hand it over to the board now for your comments.
We will.
Now, the first issues, the separations, and I heard similar complaints. And people sometimes, you know, ask questions slightly from different angle. And you said whether it's one or two steps. And some of our concerns we raised issues like whether we should use one principle rather than two principles. That's the price independent, interdependent, and the distinct function. And I'm not sure whether you heard a second the complaint, you know, whether we should use two or one principle, maintain two steps, but one principle. And this is my first question. You know, my second question relates to that issue is, if we decide to use one step and select one of the principles, is there any impact on our principles in lease contract standards and insurance standards? I'm not sure.
I think in the main, most people were just very confused by our two-step approach to segmentation. And I think those who sort of saw what the boards were trying to achieve sort of said that if we were to maintain that two-step approach, then we would have to more clearly specify the different objectives of those two steps. And that was, you know, for people, it wasn't clear enough as why you needed the two steps. But yes, we did hear the commentary about there seemed to be differences in the wording, and it wasn't sure, you know, people weren't sure whether that was deliberate or not, and of course it was. But I think overall, I think the very consistent message that we've heard there is that first step of segmenting the contract really necessary? I think it probably requires some changes to the proposals about allocation, but I, you know, we're definitely going to explore ways of just doing it with a one step, identifying separate performance obligations.
On this point,
hang on. Yes, on Weigel.
Yeah, second question.
Sorry, Weigel, I forgot your second question. I'm sorry.
I wrote one step and then one principle.
Yeah. Clearly, with that, with identifying separate performance obligations, yes, I think there is a bit of a cross-cutting issue there with both insurance and in leasing, and I think we just need to be aware of that and consider that in our re-deliberations.
Can I ask a question? So the step one and step two is now combined, and interdependency will not be there. So that means based on the contract, you will separate the performance obligation. I'm not sure. Say combining two and how to identify performance obligation.
Look, we need to be careful. We don't step into re-deliberations here. I mean. And give the impression we're making decisions on the fly. All I'm saying is that we can explore a model whereby, yes, there's clearly going to be need to be some test for combining contracts. I think most people agree that in certain cases, two or more contracts need to be combined together. But I think we do need to take a careful look at whether there's a need to segment a contract and then identify separate performance obligations within that contract.
Okay. Still, I'm not quite sure because in any case, subsequent reallocation, we need a boundary of the, say, contract or some combined contract. So,
yeah.
One step or two steps are irrelevant, I think. In any case, we need some defined.
I think you still need to define the contract, and you know, one possibility would be to sort of say that that's the arrangement that we're accounting for, and then the arrangement can consist of one or more contracts, two more contracts.
Okay, I've got Paul, Warren, and then Philippe.
I've read only a small fraction of the comment letters, but on reading them, the ones I did read, and the staff analyses, I was very struck by the strong support in the most of those letters for the core principle that was proposed in our exposure draft, which is recognized revenue when control is transferred, or you could say the goods or services have been transferred. I know we're starting from very different starting points because we have one standard, fairly general the way it's written, where U.S. literature has much more on revenue. But I was a little surprised to hear in the staff analysis that people are questioning the conceptual base of the proposal, because I think transfer, certainly for goods, is in our current literature, and I think in the U.S. as well. I think activity maybe better characterizes the percentage of completion that we have for construction contracts. And so there, yes, we're changing it, but Henry and Glenn and others have identified that this is a big issue we need to think about in redeliberation. My only point is that we shouldn't lose sight of the fact that the great majority of letters supported the board's proposals.
Can I just quickly come in and say, I think that's a fair assessment, Paul, that there's a lot of support basically for that core idea that revenue should reflect the transfer. And then, so the disquiet is about, well, how do you determine when the transfer has taken place? And it's the control tool. And I think it's fair to say, not everybody who's sort of come out and saying, well, maybe think a bit more in terms of activities, but a fair few of those, I suspect the concern is because of the way they've interpreted control, and they see it as perhaps more restrictive than I think the boards intend it to be. And therefore, you know, as we can refine that and make our intentions more clear, and we make it clearer about when you're getting continuous transfer and construction contracts, I personally think a lot of that concern about, you know, of disagreement with our proposed core principle maybe will fall away.
Yeah, thanks, Leslie. First of all, I think it's an excellent summary, and thanks for this. I think it's very helpful when this is put in the context with our own reading of the comment letters. I had a couple of questions. One of Glenn, you mentioned that there wasn't strong support for the probability weighted approach to determining consideration. That's not surprising in a way. We've heard that in other contexts. You said there seemed to be support for best estimate. My question is, did you detect a common view as to what best estimate means?
What did we say in the I think most people, we interpreted it to be a most likely outcome, although we weren't scientific in our sort of analysis of the comments to determine exactly what that might be. We acknowledged, and I think took a bit of comfort from the fact that a lot of respondents said this is a concern which they've raised in a number of different projects, and there's other staff in the organisation that are looking at this issue of probability weighting and what are the alternatives and what is the what might be the appropriate way forwards to address that. So we just tried to just record the notes. We'll move on and sort of consider that in the redeliberation.
Okay. I think there's various aspects to it, Warren, as well. But you know, one thing I heard very clearly from a lot of the roundtable participants was this, that, you know, and this was a very common message at the round tables, but people also get troubled when you're dealing with sort of low probabilities of having some revenue and high probabilities of having no revenue, you know, and that's where people got very troubled by the probability weighted. So suppose you've got 80% chance of getting nothing and a 20% chance of getting something, it sort of, probability weighting there was very troublesome to a lot of participants.
And also perhaps a belief that we would expect that you would need in all circumstances to estimate a large number of data points, which
absolutely,
is what we didn't expect.
And I think that is interesting, because definitely my impression was that perhaps the US participants in the roundtable sort of see it perhaps a more burdensome technique than maybe some of IFRS constituents do, and perceive that it requires significant data points to come up with that estimate. So they see it as not a cost-benefit way of arriving at a good revenue number.
Right. Second question relates to exchange that you had with Paul on the control notion, in particular continuous transfer of control. And it's focusing, I guess, on that issue in certain parts of the world where they, I think, saw the approach as being particularly problematic. And it probably tends to be true of the Asian region, I think, and it's focusing principally on real estate development. And the question is, do you think that there has been a misunderstanding of what it was that we intended to convey, and if we had a better articulation of the notion of continuous transfer, that many of the concerns would be overcome? Or do you think it's more fundamental than that?
Well, let's put it like this. How the control principle would apply to the retail real estate in Asia was the number one issue in that part of the world. As you know, that there's sort of concerns about how IFRIC 15 gets applied to those contracts, and therefore, because we had said, we'd made some comments that, you know, there were similarities between the ED and IFRIC 15 levels, therefore a great deal of concern about how it would get interpreted, how the ED would get interpreted. But I think it gets back to what Glenn was saying, in the sense of that was a really good example where people said, it's really difficult for us to sort of, you know, to be absolutely clear what the boards intend here, because the indicators pull us in different directions. If we look at the actual core control principle, well, direct the use of, you know, the part completed retail, the real estate, that's difficult. So, you know, I think it's a good example of highlighting where we've just got to be clearer about exactly what our intention is, so that people just can make robust and consistent interpretations when they apply it to contracts.
Please.
Thank you. Well, I would like to add to what Ron said in terms of the quality of the papers, and I would like to compliment the staff for the very good quality and the good analysis. Now, my overall feeling in reading this summary is that, yeah, people tell us you got the concepts right. The overall architecture of the model is good. However, you just over-engineered a little bit the proposals in trying to do too much in terms of segmentation, combination, and determining the onerous obligations at the performance obligation level. And people tell us also you must be consistent throughout the different models. Revenue, leasing, lessor model, insurance. And they want consistency in the unit of account for measuring, for instance, the performance obligation on the onerous contract. And they want consistency in the way we account for contract acquisition costs, which seem to be quite different between insurance and this model. So I think we have a good basis to continue our deliberations, but we have to try now to make it operational, the same as we did for impairment, or maybe some other projects. We need to make it such that it can work in practice and not being too ambitious in terms of sophistication.
I thought that the summary was excellent. I've read almost all the comment letters. One thing that Glenn talked briefly about that I want to focus on is the level of implementation guidance. Some of our stakeholders said too much, some said too little. When I read through the comment letters, it doesn't seem to be mixed. It seems to be, if you're following IFRS, broad-based, you think it's too much. If you're following US GAAP, you think it's too little. And I bring that up as I'm fearful this might be a cross-cutting issue in the level of implementation guidance that we provide, not only in this project, but in leases and insurance and financial instruments. Over the last week and a half, we've met with our Small Business Advisory Committee, which is made up of smaller public companies and private companies. They believe that the board should provide substantially more guidance. We met with our FASAC, which is all of our cross-cutting of all our stakeholders. They felt that there should be more guidance provided by the FASB. But when I asked specifically, do you think you could have a converged solution if the standard was the same but one board had more guidance than the other, they completely rejected that as a converged solution. I don't have an answer for what I think we ought to do, but I do think this is an issue that we ought to think strategically about, and we ought to think now, because at some point we're going to have to decide how much guidance do we want to put in not only this project, but leasing, financial instruments, and insurance.
Just following up on that point, it's a good one. I mean, in with respect to implementation guidance, I think it's also going to be important for another reason, and that's while absolutely 100% of the preparers and auditors that we've spoken with have commended the staff on fabulous outreach and engagement in the process, there was a little bit less from the investor and the user community. And I think part of that is because of this issue of understanding how this is going to impact them on an industry-by-industry basis. And you alluded to this, Glenn, in some of your comments. And so the implementation guidance, I think, is going to be helpful for them to analyze what the changes are going to be and whether or not, to use your words, we should, you know, whether this represents an improvement over the current standards or what's the cause for change. So I think the implementation guidance is going to be key on that, and I know the staff has identified a resource to just focus solely on that, and I think that's a really good move. One question that I have that maybe is a little bit of a nit. I mean, in the comment letters that I saw, a lot of people, not surprisingly, focus on the transfer of control and services environment, with a lot of people in the construction industry specifically saying retain current accounting. 81.1 in the U.S. at least. But I also heard from a few constituents, and most recently at the Norwalk Roundtable, that 81.1 as written is not necessarily how it's applied in today's environment, that it's almost sort of evolved. And I was curious if I was the only one that heard that, or if the staff had sort of thought about that and think about that, because retaining current guidance, if what people are actually doing doesn't reflect current guidance, I would want that reflected in the analysis for us to look at.
So I throw that to Kenny.
Thanks, Henry.
You did that to me in Washington, Kenny. So.
You're right, I deserved it. No, Mark, I think you are correct in your recollection. There was a comment made at the Norwalk Roundtable that at least some practices in the construction industry are not consistent. Well, I shouldn't say are not consistent, are not articulated in existing guidance. So I think in our outreach we have found that people think that the guidance, they acknowledge that it is a little bit outdated in terms of some of the wording. The standard is, and practices are sometimes over 30 years old. And so I think a lot of people do agree that it needs to be updated, but anything that changes sort of the core principles and the core practice would be very strongly opposed by contractors, especially, I think, as we heard from North American contractors.
Mark, can I ask you a question? It seemed to me what you were talking about was something that investors and users might need to understand how the new standard would apply. Is that something that's best met by implementation guidance, or is that something that's more for communication materials?
I'm not sure whether it's a chicken. I'm not sure if this can translate chicken or an egg type approach. I don't know. I mean, I know the staff has tried to do this, in three different webcasts for the construction, real estate, and technology sectors, and I think that was broadly helpful. But in some of the conference calls we held with users, there was another round of questions of granularity to it based on all the guidance that they have today. And so, you know, I feel like doing the implementation guidance might unearth some issues, some unintended consequences that might not otherwise be, you know, come to light.
Yeah. I mean, we've definitely heard that users would like more very clear before after examples, and as we highlighted in the project plan, you know, as we firm up some of the conclusions in the redeliberation, that's something that we intend to sort of target specifically.
I guess my comment there, Peter, is just that there, while generally in the comment letters there was absolutely broad support for the principle of converging across geographies and across industries the accounting guidance, and certainly there's a, you know, an understanding on my part that you can't have a small board, however big it is, to try to write guidance for every individual sector all the time and keep up to date. However, the way that the investing community, at least in many jurisdictions, works is analyzed on a sector-by-sector basis. And so when they're trying to analyze whether or not what's the broad cause for change, if it impacts them and it increases comparability across sectors, but their whole world is comparability within the sector, it's a little bit more tricky.
Paul, and then Wigwo.
I wanted just to comment on when looking at letters that say keep the current guidance, we don't see a reason for change. I was struck by Glenn's summary of comments on measurement. Many said they were concerned about changing to a fair value measurement of the revenue. We've got a 30-year-old standard also, and it's crystal clear to me. One sentence is absolutely, all it took was one sentence. It says, revenue shall be measured at the fair value of the consideration you receive. We are not proposing anything new that's been around 30 years. In fact, that sentence is followed by a second sentence that says, if payment is deferred, measure at the discounted present value. Now, then we go on and fuzz it up a little bit by saying, if there is a financing element to the transaction, so people can judge, well, maybe it wasn't really, even though payment is deferred 3 years, there's no financing element. So what we're trying to do really in this proposal is just clarify what has been the standard for the last 30 years. And so we need, when people say, well, I like to keep the current guidance, we've got to maybe sometimes take that with a bit of, what they say, a grain of salt.
No, I should say, this is a marvelous paper. I spent 4 hours just read this. But I still find one area is missing.
A totally different language background, you see. Slowly.
comments are missing. That is the we defined the transfer of control from the buy side. And many of our constituencies say, you know, maybe we should look at this issue from both sides, depend on the contract. And I'm not sure whether, you know, the staff think, you know, you intentionally miss that part, or you think that kind of comments is useful for further improve our principle.
Well, all I would say is that, you know, actually that we had a good discussion about that in at one of the round tables in Norwalk, and I think, you know, we all agree that it could be helpful to think about it from both sides. So we will explore that.
Any other comments or questions?
Okay, thank you. Well, if there are no more questions on either that or the appendix or the outreach activity, I suggest we move on to paper C. So that's paper 3C, 134C, which is the redeliberation plan. And Kenny, if you'd like to introduce that. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Henry. So this paper proposes a plan for the board's redeliberation of the issues that have just been discussed, that have come out of the comment letters and other outreach activities. And as Glenn and Libby described, and I think Paul also noted, there is a lot of support for the board's efforts and the objective of creating a single model that improves and converges existing revenue recognition requirements. However, a lot of people do question whether a single model can be applied consistently across the wide range of industries within the scope of the project. And as discussed previously, the staff thinks that those concerns relate to what we call the two fundamental revenue issues, and those issues being control and separation. And because of the fundamental nature of those issues and really the interrelationship of those issues, the staff thinks that that the boards need to consider those issues immediately and previous to the other remaining issues. So the plan at the moment is to analyze those issues and take a recommendation to the boards in January, so just next month. Now, in paragraph 8 of this paper, we have included a table that summarizes what we're calling the other or less fundamental revenue issues. And these issues include, I won't get into detail, but they do include topics such as time value of money, collectability, probability-weighted estimates, warranties, the onerous test, and disclosures. And for many of these issues, we found that people agree with or at least understand the concept, but there are a lot of concerns about the practicality of the proposals and whether the benefits of applying the proposals would exceed the costs. So the analysis of these other issues, so the issues in the table, the staff has started to analyze those issues, and the plan at the moment is to take a recommendation to the boards on these issues, not all of them, but starting in February, as soon as we first address the fundamental issues of control and separation. Now, paragraph 11 highlights some of the concerns or I guess issues for redeliberation regarding the cost proposals in the exposure draft. And really the exposure draft sort of drew a line between the cost of obtaining a contract and the cost of fulfilling a contract. And of course, the cost of obtaining a contract, the proposal was to expense all of them. But many people think that at least some direct incremental costs, such as selling commissions, should be capitalized. The plan is to take that issue as soon as possible to the boards following the January meeting. And then the issue of fulfillment costs, we think is a little bit thornier, and that will probably follow the issue of cost to obtain the contract. The good news is we're very pleased to have Phil Hood join the revenue team. So he's joined the revenue team to work on costs. So he will be working full time to analyze these issues, and of course that analysis will occur simultaneously with the analysis of the revenue issues. So getting to the timeline in paragraph 13. This table, it's a very high-level summary of the staff's proposed timing and sequencing of the issues that have been raised. And Appendix A does include additional detail on each of these topics. Of course, we'll take questions and comments now, but if the board wants to see further detail, we do have that. A couple of notes on the timeline, though. The staff does intend to do what we're calling targeted outreach throughout redeliberations, and really we've identified a lot of supporters of the standard setting process in the comment letter. So using this network of supporters of the process, we do intend to have a sort of informal consultation as we develop staff or board papers and so throughout redeliberations. A lot of respondents have also requested testing of the completed model. So once redeliberations are substantially complete, but before the standard is finalized, a lot of people have asked the boards, including at the roundtables, I think it was a common theme, people have asked the boards to test the completed model to minimize the risk of unintended consequences, and also really because of the breadth of scope of the project, many people feel that's necessary. So That's a decision the boards will have to make at a later date. Now, the last section of the plan discusses the risks with the proposed timeline, and really the staff has identified two. The first is an aggressive timeline. I think that one goes without saying. Although the boards will need to consider not just this timeline, but how it matches up with other projects. The second risk is one that I think goes to the comment that Russ made earlier, and there was a bit of discussion, and that's the implementation guidance. And again, because of the breadth of scope of this project, the comment letters have come in from a very wide array of industries, as Libby listed previously, and there is a risk that in the process of developing implementation guidance for these industries, or at least analyzing the concerns more closely, there could be additional issues that need to go back to the boards for redeliberation. The good news, of course, is that we have added a full-time resource at the FASB, Mike Breen, who will be focusing on this exclusively so that work can occur simultaneously as we redeliberate the other topics. So, final comment, I know Mark raised this a moment ago, the user outreach. We do highlight in paragraph 14 that we do need to increase outreach to users of financial statements, in particular when I think as the effects of applying the proposal or the standard become clearer, we do need to make sure that we increase our communication to explain any potential changes to users of financial statements. So with that, I will turn over to the boards for any questions or comments.
Question? Tom? Weibo?
My question relates to the issues Rob just raised. Let's assume we still have the June 2011 deadline. Now, if we don't have that deadline, I think the redirection will be totally different. If we still have the deadline, my question to the staff is, do you envisage we should take into those implementation issues into the whole package we intend to publish before June 2011? Or we finalize the principal standards first and leave many of the implementation issues to the future?
I think I perhaps can comment only on the experience that staff observed when developing the exposure draft. And when developing the exposure draft, I think we did find that developing the implementation guidance did sometimes change, of course, not fundamental principles of the standard, but did change sometimes the articulation of the standard. But that's, I think that's something that the board will have to decide.
Okay, Ross had two hands up.
Yeah, the way I think about the implementation guidance issue is first is the development and the publishing. And I think development is something that's important for the staff and the boards to do to make sure we understand where the impact's going to be by industry to ensure that there isn't a hole in the standard. I don't think that just because we develop it means we have to publish it. I think publishing the implementation guidance has a bunch of different implications. Do you go away from principles and force rules and all sorts of macro issues? But I think why we put Mike on the project was so that we could make sure that there weren't any holes or missteps in the development of the model.
And I would just add to that, I agree that the staff has identified the two most important, most complex issues as control and segmentation, and they're bringing it to us first, deliberately, so that we can try and reach decisions on that and start the outreach immediately and concurrently. So implicit in your question was almost a premise that we don't have time to do all of it. And I think the staff has developed the plan to try and start the outreach as soon as we reach decisions on various topics. Also, of course, to the extent that we don't change things or we change things in a way that's more consistent with what people are asking, et cetera, it very much changes the equation of how much outreach we need, I think. Larry?
Well, and following on to that, I also think that depending upon how we deal with those two fundamental issues, that might influence the degree to which people are asking for implementation guidance. I think, and I could very well be in an extreme minority here, but I found it interesting that so many commentators indicated that they supported a single model and the control-based model. However, at the same time, so many of the issues raised with respect to lack of implementation guidance, et cetera, revolved around how to apply that single model. Personally, I think most people in this room, if you ask them, should revenue be recognized in this set of circumstances and that set of circumstances, would all fundamentally agree. And I would hate for the staff to spend an inordinate amount of time trying to take that control notion and continue to evolve it so that it applies to situations that might appear to be very, very different. I would hate for us to, you know, take the sledgehammer and make it bigger and bigger and try to pound the square peg into a round hole when it doesn't work. I mean, I agree with Guigo. I agree with what PK was saying. I think we have two fundamentally different set of circumstances where we believe revenue ought to be recognized. The control model works very well in one, and it doesn't work so well in the other one. It's hard to articulate. People don't quite understand it, and it really creates some fundamental problems. And I personally would rather see time spent on developing criteria that you have to get through in order to get revenue recognized in a service-type arrangement or what have you. And I just throw that out because I think that's going to influence the timing of the plan. I think if we can get that out of the way up front, I think that's going to influence the degree to which we need implementation guidance, et cetera. And I would just encourage us to explore that wholeheartedly.
I think, Larry, I mean, one of the things that we've been exploring is sort of saying, you know, our theoretical control concept, you can keep that, but put that into the basis, as it were. I think the real issue is that how do you best get people to understand what we want to happen, given the fact that this standard is going to be read by a huge, you know, we'll never write a standard, as Leslie sort of always reminds us, that will be read by such a wide array of people. And therefore, maybe in the standard, it's just better to talk directly to goods and services, you know, and highlight the continuous, the situations where you have a continuous service, and just, as you say, clearly sort of specify the criteria that when those circumstances would apply. And that could all be within the context still of an overall single conceptual model, but we've just written it in a way that people can quickly get to the answers, and, you know, you and I would, as two prepared, could come up with the same answer reasonably quickly and robustly. And I think that's what we need to explore. I agree.
Thanks. In terms of implementation guidance, I hope that what we end up doing, and maybe part of the difference between what happens in IFRS literature and in US GAAP, is sometimes we in US GAAP write implementation guidance that takes the principles that are in the standard and repeat them in a fact pattern where there isn't a lot of doubt how they work and apply. And I hope that that's not what we choose to do in implementation guidance. I think what implementation guidance would be most useful for is situations where that principle has some gray in its application in a particular circumstance, and there's factors or circumstances that you have to apply judgment to decide how it would be applied. And I think if we were to be able to seek out a development of implementation guidance that help us where there are some gray in terms of how to apply in a situation and provide some further context about what the board's intent was related to the application of those standards when it is gray, I think the implementation guidance has much value to be added. where repeating black and white decisions, I don't think it helps much. Some of what I see in a list of where people want implementation guidance is they just want their fact pattern written up so that we move from 186 pieces of guidance that are industry-based in U.S. GAAP and they can run back to find their contract or their fact pattern in an implementation guidance, and all they'll do is run to that implementation guidance. My fear is that defeats the standard itself, and we don't want to go down that path. It ought to be finding strategic ways to apply the guidance.
I've got Elka, PK, Weiguo, and then Larry.
Thank you. I've got a slightly different topic. Looking at the list, the table on the paragraph 8, there are 10 topics on. Now, we've heard that some of the topics, we've got it conceptually right. There's a lot of merits to it, but it's over-engineered or it's overly complex, and is it really worthwhile? My question would be, would it be helpful to staff if, in January, we can discuss those topics on a high level and see which of them really need to be discussed or which of them we just don't touch and leave it as is, so that we're not killing all the trees on the earth, but are really concentrating on those topics that are really worthwhile. We've discussed some time ago about not to change things if there's no real need for change. So would that be something that would be helpful to staff? Or is it just creating additional complexity?
Well, I think it certainly would be helpful if we, you know, sort of in advance had kind of general leanings of the boards. I think it is really a question for the boards in terms of, you know, how do you want to go through the redeliberation process? You know, we could take these 9-10 issues, we could flesh them out and put together a more robust table in January, February, and get sort of leanings. I think the only question in my mind would be, you know, how would that be viewed in terms of due process? Would it be acceptable because they are concepts we've already deliberated in the past, and maybe we're headed towards the direction that people supported in response to the exposure draft? Or do the boards need time to sift through more of the analysis? I think that's a question for the boards, perhaps.
I think another way of expressing Elka's point is, if there are a list of items which, in retrospect, seem like they were nice theoretically when we exposed them, but based on the overwhelming commentary we received, are just not necessary for us to address at this point. So I'd almost view it as the list of low-hanging fruit for, you know, you to give us a list like that and us to say, we agree, we're going to take it out of the model, or whatever. Maybe there's some simple fix. Larry?
Yeah, I would follow up, and the board members heard this morning, but I would request that your team take a look at a document that the leasing team prepared for the board advisors meeting, okay? And basically it's a grid of the issues, some potential ways of dealing with those issues, and then an analysis, low, high, or medium, as to the conceptual merit of the arguments, the cost of implementing, and a few other things. And take a look at that format and prepare that fairly early on, like now, like in January. Bring it to the boards after we get through the first two conceptual, the high-level conceptual issues, and say, okay, here's an initial staff reaction to this, some of which would be, as Leslie said, slam dunks, you know, we don't need to consider it much at all, and that might address the very first risk that you have in terms of aggressive timing.
Right. Yeah.
I know that the issue table that you're referring to, actually I think we've pinned a lot of these down to a choice of sort of say two, and it really will boil down to so to take warranties, for example. You know, as Glenn highlighted, a lot of people would like to get something closer to the current accounting for warranties. There's another alternative for the boards, which is to perhaps get closer to what we have in the discussion paper, but just, which I think is what we were trying to do with ED, but we made it too complicated, simplify it. I think you've got a trade-off there between the one that's got a slightly, you know, perhaps deals with that conceptual concern we had about front-end and the profit recognition, versus the other one, well, is it always worth sort of separating as, you know, some of these warranties when they're very short term, so there's a cost benefit thing. And I think it's simply a choice between those two. And that's what we've done with a lot of these issues like collectability, time value, money. So we have various options for you, and I think you're simply going to have to sort of just balance those sort of competing trade-offs. I mean, we can certainly sort of perhaps sort of share more of our thinking where we are to sort of speed up the operation.
Yeah, well, just to follow up, in this case, I would argue that it's fairly clear what we're talking about. Can we take a decision on that before we are elaborating it once again and again?
And I think, don't forget also that the summary of the issues here, we've already passed this. This is sort of like high level key stuff that will need to be in the model one way or the other. We can't ignore the issue. So you have to make a decision. We'll have a second tier of issues that we are hoping to try and deal with much more on an exception basis, whereby, you know, we'll sort of list a sort of like an appendix and sort of say, this is what we've done, and get you to sort of agree on an exception basis.
I've got PK and then Wigwell.
I want to make two comments on these re-deliberation plans. Picking on what Tom said, the comment letters that I read said that many of the examples are too simplistic. And I think there is a fair amount of truth, because I also said that when I was commenting. So self-serving. Be that as it may. That's one side of it. And this, I attended almost, out of five roundtables, I attended four of them. And one comment that was made in Norwalk, and I think it's a very good comment the lady has made, is that when we looked at the asset management, this issue snuck up on us, and we didn't even think about it. It came to us in the last 10 days, even though the exposure draft was out for many days, and it snuck up on them. I want to understand from the staff, what, if any, plans we have already thought through in this, in terms of identifying, we don't want 186 implementation guidance questions, but at the same time, what kind of a filter do we plan to have such that we identify the issues that are pertinent to certain implementation guidance issues that might come up, so that we have a plan, how do we touch base with people? Because shipping industry, for example, when Jan and I were in Copenhagen and Oslo, shipping industry said, so if a ship leaves from Houston to New York, do we recognize revenue or not? I said, yeah, you recognize it under facts and circumstances. Yeah, you can recognize. But they say, where is it in the implementation guidance?
But I think, though, that's more of a general concern about how do you apply the control principle to services.
So I think there's a fine balance we need to achieve that, and I just wanted to make sure that how do we get the population of the questions? How do we get that, and how do we filter through? I think that's something I don't need an answer right now. I just wanted to
see. In the first instance, we have to identify all that. So that's what Mike is doing, is sort of trawling the letters for every single sort of specific question. The other thing that we're doing is that there were a lot of commentaries written about the ED, some very extensive, very thoughtful analysis prepared by various bodies, a lot from the accounting firms. And we're going through that to identify situations whereby either we actually see that firms have interpreted what we had in ED differently, which highlights an issue in of itself, or where they sort of say it's not clear to us how you would apply it to this particular type of contract. And they've done a lot of outreach themselves within their network. So we've got a good sort of starting base for sort of the surfacing of those issues.
The other thing, I agree with that. The other thing is that I forgot the name of the entity, but it's a healthcare provider. And he said, my contract is with the insurance companies and my contract is with the individual people.
Yep.
So which contract do I need to run with? And I, to be honest with you, we were only focusing on airline industry and things like that, airline seats. But this issue is excellent. And I wanted to make sure that we tap into those things, at least to understand what is a pervasive cross-cutting issue. The second point I want to make is that, and I do appreciate the staff has been very careful in labeling the paper as a re-deliberation plan, and also the prologue to paragraph 13 is again talks about re-deliberation plan. Be that, I'm slightly curious, what do we do after May 2011? What is it? Is it implicit in this? There is a standard coming out. Do you want to extend that? Where do we go with that, extending this timeline beyond May 2011? I would like to hear what, if any, plans are there or you want to assess at that point in time. What is the strategy there?
Well, you're right, PK. It was intentionally written as the re-deliberation plan. I think the plan is to take it to there and see what happens, because there are a lot of variables right now that make it very difficult to plan, including the starting in January with the deliberation of the fundamental issues. And then I think Larry mentioned earlier, depending on that, how that goes, that can affect the implementation guidance that might be required. It can affect sort of the testing we do subsequently. So I think there are a lot of variables that make it difficult to answer that question.
I mean, just to highlight that we've thought about the sequencing quite careful here, so that, in terms of deploying our resources and how we do the drafting, this doesn't mean to say that we start drafting in May. That's not how this is structured.
On one of your earlier points, PK, about examples and people's desire for more sophisticated examples, I think that's unrealistic, to be honest. We tend to put in very simple examples. What people want is examples that show interplayer complex judgments. We're not going to do that. It's not realistic.
No, I respect that, but I think our examples are too simplistic. I think there is a healthy medium in between. I'm not suggesting we got to go to every complex and solve every auditing or accounting question out there. But at the same time, I think our examples are too simplistic, and we got to acknowledge the overwhelming comment on that. And that's all I'm trying to say.
Can I just follow on, Henry? And it relates to a discussion that Mark and I think Larry and some others were having a moment ago, and Tom actually, about the structure of the document. Our documents we structure in terms of the principles and application guidance, and I guess it's always difficult to know how much application guidance you need. I think the broad approach is that we try to get to the point where we feel comfortable that that's adequate guidance to give us confidence that the principles will be applied as intended, and it's always difficult to know just how to pitch that. Then we have what we call implementation guidance, which is educational material, and that's provided by our education department, if you like. And I know that's different to the way you tend to structure your documents. That's just to give some context. But my question is, given the nature of this particular project, this standard in both our sets of literature, its broad application to a whole range of circumstances, is there an intention that from our perspective, that our education people will provide educational material fairly quickly? In other words, that it will be part of the package. In other words, they're going to troll, as they've done in other cases, trawl through board papers, use examples, enhance those examples, picking up some of the points PK made. Is that a plan? And if not, seems to me it should be part of the plan.
I think at the moment we've been focusing on the guidance that will be part of the document and therefore will be authoritative, because in the ED we didn't have three tiers. We didn't have the three tiers. We had a proposed standard, and then we had, I can't remember what they call it, application guidance or implementation guidance, but that was proposed authoritative material, and we structured it that way to try and simplify the structure of the standard. Now, I think there's another cross-cutting issue that we need to think about here, which is, of course, the codification structures the material differently to how we've traditionally structured our standards. And so it's quite possible that the documents will not be structured in entirely the same way, even though we can have the same words and the same level of guidance. But at the moment, we had not thought about the sort of educational material that might be produced here by Mike Wells' team.
But you will.
Yeah. But I think we really first got to sort of focus on that guidance that effectively is going to be an integral part of the standard, even if we choose to sort of to follow our usual structure of having it sort of split between the main principles and then some supporting material in a separate in an appendix.
Before, did you want to say something?
Now, one fundamental question related to the basic model is to what extent we should take into consideration risk-reward notion and the activity or earning process notions. And my view is it may not necessary for us to say there are three models or four models from beginning. When we start with the DPI against the notions, we have different models. And if you link our discussion on consolidation, leasing, and the de-recognition, we say our basic model is control model, but risk reward still have room there. And in consolidation, we have the final principle say, you know, you take into consideration all the factors and circumstances and to decide. And my suggestion is, you know, maybe it will help us to speed up our discussion. We maintain control notions, but at the same time, we say, you know, under certain circumstances, this reward activity or earning process are key determinants. I'm not sure whether this is one of the ways to weigh out. Otherwise, if we were just like Tom said, we have black, white, two models, and against each other, it would be very hard. My notion is, you know, recognize there is room of risk rewards and earning process, especially for the earning process, especially related to the service contract.
At this stage, I don't want to discuss what we should do, but just look at the scenario and what they mean for our deliberations on timeline. If in January or February the boards were to decide to bifurcate a modified or a different model for services, and or for construction services, construction industry contracts, which is a form of service maybe, how would that impact the strategy and the timeline of deliberations? Is it compatible with this February to May timeline or not?
Yes, I think it is, because I think we envisage that there's going to be some changes around the control and separation. So I think it's implicit in that.
Kenny, did you want to get in?
Yeah, if I may, I just have two, I think, clarification questions that I want to ask the boards before our time is up. One is, Leslie, you mentioned the testing along the way. It's also something that we talk about in the paper. We do intend to do this targeted outreach. I just want to quickly explain kind of what we plan to do and make sure that's consistent with what the boards want. I think the thinking at the moment is that as the staff is preparing a board paper, say we're preparing a paper on control or separation, of course we'll be relying on some of the very thoughtful comment letters, and to the extent we, you know, see a thoughtful comment from the comment letters, we intend to pick up the phone and call the sender of that comment letter to bounce ideas off that person, see if our current thinking on staff recommendation would address that concern. So it's a very informal consultation, sort of picking up the phone, calling people, and not anything more formal than that. I just want to make sure that the boards are okay with that form of testing throughout redeliberations. The second question is regarding, I think, Elka's point on the table or the grid of so-called low-hanging fruit. Is that something that the boards, is there agreement that the staff should bring such a table in January or perhaps February?
Any, Pat?
That was a yes.
Here, wait.
To Kenny's question about whether that's sufficient. I know some of the organizations that I've been observing have expressed concern about the lack of transparency in our field work, and they've asked if we would be bringing a paper to the board that summarized what we did and how we did it, not necessarily naming who we met with, but just summarizing the outreach, because we say we're doing it, but they don't actually see it or feel it or understand it. And so they've asked that we somehow make that whole process more transparent. So if you could just think about that.
Kenny, on your point about casual conversations along the way, I'm not sure one size fits all. For example, if we change the way we express the way you would apply the control notion to a long-term construction contract, for example, I would definitely want to meet with a bunch of construction companies and make sure that they see it that way as well and that it's operational, et cetera. I mean, there are certain issues here that are of such a level of concern that I would want to have a meeting with people and make sure that we're understanding each other. But
it's not just in the United States. It doesn't make it an issue.
PK said not just in the United States. In Europe, too.
Okay, and I think that is correct, that there is not a one-size-fits-all for all the outreach. I suppose the concern I do have somewhat is that if we have sort of a global outreach that's public, industry forums, of course, it would need to be global. I think we could lose some momentum in redeliberations, on top of the fact that a lot of these issues are interrelated. So if we're meeting with contractors to talk about, say, control and separation, they do have concerns about other topics such as change orders, of course, everything around the transaction price. So there is an interrelationship of issues that could make it difficult to do sort of global, and I don't know if this is you envision a workshop or something like this, but I do agree that it does vary by topic, so we can keep that in mind.
Okay. Kenny, I wanted to, first of all, I think what you're talking about in terms of outreach is necessary. I don't know that it's sufficient. I think we get to judge that in May as to whether along the way gave us enough. I think outreach forums in certain areas are going to be necessary. I also wanted to say, you asked the second question, do we want a low-hanging fruit memo? I don't know that any of us responded, but I saw a lot of nods when you asked that question around the table, so I just wanted to observe that there were nods going on at that time. But what the point I wanted to raise was, in listening to our discussion today, I've heard more than a at least a significant minority of people sort of beginning to think about whether or not they want a separate model for construction or not. And I just wanted to raise that to the staff. I don't think that's the right way to go. I think we've made a mistake by using the word control, because control to me relates to goods, and control is sort of I've got all of the control. Where I really think the model is a transfer notion model, and you can have continuous transfer with that doesn't mean all of the control, and I don't even know that you can control a service, but there are other ways of looking at this, and if you've got a good transferred with a continuous service, you're certainly not going to have 100% control of that good through time because it's coming to you over time. I think a transfer notion is another way to begin to at least try to think about this. But I just wanted to raise for the staff, it seems to me, and listening at the table and watching the table, there is a significant minority that have suggested maybe we've got to split this thing versus trying to develop the transfer notion, if for better terms, that I want to say it more fully to relate to it. That is probably a very significant issue that needs to be addressed pretty quickly for us to decide how to go forward, because it seems to me, in listening to people, it'll be lurking there if we don't decide whether we have two models or one model.
Just a brief point on that. Some point. This is why I carefully use the term construction services,
mm-hmm.
which is to me a form of service, and the notion of transfer of service would apply probably to many construction contracts.
And I think we're going to have the problem if we split the model is to have to decide what a service is to go into the other model, just like we have to decide how to handle a service in the big model.
I mean, just say, Tom, I agree with you, but I think, you know, we can always keep transfer at the top, and then it's a question about you try to articulate that with one sort of set of grey text to support that idea, or do you sort of split it? But it could always fit under the transfer notion, and perhaps, you know, we should be making more of the core principle, because the way people keep saying about transfer of control, well, actually the model was transfer, control was how you determine whether the transfer has taken place. So I think that just emphasizes, we should emphasize the transfer, and then it's just how do you best explain when that's occurred.
Well, it seems to me you're saying transfer, and then we have two things under transfer under one model. I hear others saying,
yeah,
two models.
Well, I think we should, well, personally, I think we should try to retain the, this is one model, but that may require two different sets of articulation.
That's what I meant. Right.
Yeah, I agree with what Henry just said about that, but I just want to kind of caution this low-hanging fruit concept. I mean, when I look at the table that starts on page 3, we could go around the room, and some of us would say some of this is low-hanging fruit, and others of us would say this is extremely important. You know, Mark Siegel is going to say disclosure is extremely important. It's not low-hanging fruit. Some of them are going to be dependent upon other issues. So I'm 100% behind. If we have low-hanging fruit, get it done. Get it done when it makes the most sense. But I don't want us to leave the room thinking that some of this stuff is really easy and we can get it done in 5 minutes, because we can.
I don't think – I may have held up the paper when I said it, but I certainly didn't mean everything on it met those conditions. Okay. Okay. Any final comments on this? We're at a little over time. Okay. Thank you very much. I thought it was a great package of material.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Kenny and team. Should we meet back at 5-2?
Yeah, we know that.
5-2.